The song of invitation will be 592. 592.
We did a lot of the introductory work to this lesson a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to go back through those slides very quickly. If you are wanting to take notes, I suggest, especially for the first half of these slides, that you get your cell phone out and take pictures, because they're not going to be up on the screen very long for you to take massive notes. If you were here before, you should be in good shape if you took notes at that time. According to the Assemblies of God website, the end times will be full of frightening events. Christians will be spared from suffering, some of them by being snatched away in the rapture. But we will not escape them all, and Christ gave warning and instruction on how to live in the last days in Matthew 24. The Jeremiah Project is quoted as saying, "Our Lord told us not to be troubled, because these are only the beginning of birth pains." And this is also in Matthew 24 and verse 8. I believe that God is warning the world. The world has broken his covenant and gone away from him, and these events are warnings designed to turn us to him. Also from the Jeremiah Project, the only way to understand the big picture is to look at the Bible and the various categories of signs that the Bible predicted would come together just before the return of Christ. The key to understanding current events is in some familiar old scriptural passages. Jesus himself gave us the best insight shortly before his execution on the cross. That is also referencing Matthew 24. David Jeremiah has a new book that is out about the world of the end. And he's talking about the Bible study in Matthew 24, bringing it forward. The future of the entire world is in his hands as well. Every sentence in Matthew 24 is addressed to you. Every sentence of Matthew 24 is addressed to you. This is written in 2022. From his book. During the final week of his natural life, our Lord rolled out the blueprint of the ages, a master plan for the last days. The massive temple complex, he said, would soon come tumbling down, every single stone. Then Jesus gazed further ahead into the world of the end, and he told us what would happen in the precarious days prior to his return. And he lists 10 signs the tribulation is drawing near. You want to take a picture of that. I'm not going to read all of those, but each of them is referenced in Matthew 24, taken from this section of Scripture. Here are the last four right here. So what is taught in premillennialism with regard to Matthew 24 is that there are signs that Jesus gave us that will appear just prior to his return, and that the warning is for end-time Christians, and he gives instructions there in Matthew 24 to end-time Christians. Contextually, this is where we have to bear down in order to understand Matthew 24. Beginning in chapter 21 of Matthew, you have the triumphal entry, that is the week of his passion. He comes in on Sunday, he's dead on Friday, if we use modern vernacular for the days of the week. He cleanses the temple, he curses the fig tree, his authority is questioned. Why, who gave you authority to do all of these things? He tells the parable of the two sons. The two sons, both of them he told to go and do their job. One said, "I will not," but he relented and did his job. The other said, "I will," but he refused to do it. And he was there, he was laying some heavy stuff on the Pharisees and the scribes at that time. He also told the parable of the wicked vine dressers who killed all of the master's servants and then killed his son so that the kingdom could be theirs, the vineyard could be theirs. He condemns the religious leaders there in the final part. In Matthew 22, we have the parable of the wedding feast. We have the Pharisees plotting against Jesus, the Sadducees plotting against Jesus. When they were defeated, both of those two were defeated, the Pharisees came back for a second helping, and then Jesus silenced them at the end of that chapter. Chapter 23 is known for its woes that are prescribed to the scribes and Pharisees. He is not playing nice anymore. He's had over 3 years, and he's up to here with the religious leaders who were rejecting everything that he showed them regarding who he was and the miracles that even told who he was. John chapter 11, he raises Lazarus from the dead who's been in the tomb for 4 days. The response of the religious leaders, they're going to kill Lazarus because he was proof. I want you to think about that. They're going to kill this man because he was proof. Read John chapter 11. It's right there. Then Jesus laments over Jerusalem. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, I want you to pay attention now. The teacher in me keeps coming out, and I say this a lot, and I say, repetition is for your learning. But it's also in case somebody here that hasn't heard this before, where it says C-H-A-P-T-E-R, and then the number 24, that's not part of the original text. That was inserted later to help us find our way through the scriptures. We broke things down into chapters. Sometimes the chapter headings interrupt context. This is that case. He is lamenting over Jerusalem. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to him to show him the buildings of the temple. So you see that where he's lamenting Jerusalem, immediately it follows, they're coming out and they're saying how beautiful this place is. We're going to get to that here in just a few moments. Jesus and his temple prediction comes about. They ask him 3 questions about that statement when they get over to the Mount of Olives. He answers those 3 questions, but he does not answer them in order, and he actually gives answers to those questions in multiple places in the text. You have to go looking for it. That's the mistake most people make, is they think he is sequentially answering those questions, and he's not. You have to understand the question, then read the answer to know which answer goes with which question. Then he talks about the faithful and evil servant at the end. Matthew chapter 25, in the same context, we have the parable of the virgins, the 5 wise and 5 foolish virgins. We have the parable of the talents. And then we have Jesus talking about the judgment and the separation of the sheep and the goats. This is the context in which Matthew 24 is found. It is not an isolated chapter that sits on an island by itself. It must be understood where it is found. If you don't do that and take into account what Mark 13 and Luke 21 bring to bear on this, because they report on this same situation, if you don't bring all those things together, it's easy to misconstrue what is taking place here. The destruction of Jerusalem is what is under consideration in Matthew 24. The Jewish war began in AD 66. It lasted approximately 5 years. During that period of time, 5 emperors ruled and were overthrown. 4 of them in an 18-month period. So you can see there was civil war taking place in the Roman Empire, not just the Jewish war that was taking place in Judea. Famine is a natural result of civil war. It is also the natural result of cities being laid siege. They cannot get food supplies in, and people starve to death. Food then became extremely scarce. False prophets and imposters were going out, deceiving many. Earthquakes were reported in 8 parts of the Mediterranean world by Grotius during this period of time. 8 separate parts. Cestius Gallus surrounded Jerusalem in AD 67, but he inexplicably withdrew his troops to Caesarea. This gave Christians an opportunity to escape from Jerusalem. He was fired. Titus was put in charge. This is I was asked this question. This is not the Titus that we read about in the New Testament. The letter sent to Titus, he was a co-worker of the Apostle Paul's. This is Titus, the general in the Roman army. He laid siege to Jerusalem from April to September of AD 70. 1.1 million people were killed in the siege of Jerusalem and in its destruction. 30,000 men were crucified upon the walls. Now, I'm going to read from Josephus here in just a few minutes. I'm not going to read about it at this time, but some of this information is also found there. So we're going to get a little bit further into Matthew 24 so everything can make sense. Josephus, if you're not aware, he was a secular Jew. He was not a practicing Jew, but he wrote a lot of history and he worked for the Romans. And he recorded the events that were taking place during this period of time. And he recorded great detail about these things. And this book is the works of Josephus. It's kind of heavy, so I wonder how he carried it around all the time with him. But there are a number of books within this book. This is a compilation of his different books. And some of them deal with the war. Some deal with the antiquities of the Jews, and it gives a history of those things. He even talks about Jesus Christ in here. And he makes mention, he was not a believer, but he mentions that Jesus was raised from the dead. He doesn't say they said he was raised from the dead. He mentions he was raised from the dead. This is not a sympathetic witness to the resurrection of Jesus. It was a known truth even without the Christian community. Roman soldiers entered the temple, removed the ornaments and all of the things that were found there in the temple. Pagan symbols were then set up in the temple. Say that three times fast. The demolition of the temple was ordered, fire was set, and these huge cedar beams that came out of Lebanon many years earlier were very dry, and they're inside of these huge stones, so you have a kiln, and it became extremely hot. Very quickly, the roof was overlaid in gold. That gold melted, ran down between the cracks of all of those stones. Once those stones cooled enough to be able to touch them, the Roman soldiers came and pried every stone down so they could scrape out the gold for themselves, thus fulfilling the prophecy that not one stone was left upon another, but all will be cast down. So, let's get to the text. I did that as quickly as I could, and it's already a quarter till, and I apologize. We were a little bit late getting started because we were having a problem with our projection. Appreciate Jeff and Nate working so hard to make that happen. Then Jesus departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. I want to direct you to Luke 21, verses 5 and 6. Luke 21, verses 5 and 6. Then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, "These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone will be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." In Matthew's account, "Do you not see these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone will be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." They came to show him the buildings. Luke records for us what they were saying about the buildings, how beautiful they were. Look at these magnificent buildings. You know, during the days of Jeremiah, the Jews thought they were safe because they had the temple. They even said it. You know, we're hosting the temple. We're going to be fine. And Nebuchadnezzar came in, took them, and destroyed the temple. By God's order, he did those things. Back to chapter 24. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, verse 3, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, When will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Folks, that's three distinct questions that are asked right there. That is not one question with three parts. These are three separate questions. When will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming? In Mark chapter 13 and verse 4, Mark records it. What will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? Luke records, what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? So when you read what Mark 13 says, and you read what Luke 21 says, and you insert that into Matthew 24, when they are asking him, when are these things going to happen that you just talked about with the temple? That's what they're asking him. Now, they asked him additional questions extending this out. They asked him, what is the sign of your coming? Now, when Jesus answers this question, he's talking about coming in judgment on Jerusalem. And then the end of the age. Those are three different things. So when will these things be? This is talking about the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem. And not one stone being left upon another. That's what Jesus had just told them. And they come to him and say, when's this going to happen? When's this, you know, what's going on here? We don't understand these things. Now remember, get inside the mind of the apostles. What's getting ready to happen Friday? Jesus is going to die. What happened on Thursday night when he was arrested? They still didn't believe it. They still didn't believe that he was going to die. They believe everything was going to be okay. So they're confused about all of this. What will be the sign of your coming? Verse 30, he says, the sign will appear in heaven. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Whenever you see God, or a reference to the Godhead, or Jesus Christ, the Son of Man, coming on clouds, Old and New Testament, it always refers to the coming judgment. The coming of judgment. Specifically, he's talking about the coming of judgment on Jerusalem. That will be explained here in just a moment. The Son of Man coming on the clouds is not a happy time, because most people are going to be mourning when he comes for the ultimate judgment. When he came in judgment, even the Romans said, Josephus records it, even the Romans said, only God could have allowed this to happen, because an army of men could not make this happen by themselves, because the destruction was so great. What will be the sign of the end of the age? There are two possibilities of what they're asking here. One is the Jewish economy. When is the Jewish system going to end? Or the end of the Christian age? The Christian age had not yet come. So more than likely, they're talking about the end of the Jewish economy. But Jesus goes on to answer the ultimate question of when will be the end of time. Now, to answer the question about the destruction of the temple, we go to verses 4 through 29 and 32 through 35. As I said, the answers are broken up. You have to go find them. Now, many of the historical occurrences that he talks about here occurred between 66 and 70. They occurred between 66 and 70. Now, when you look at verse 15, I'm gonna pick a few verses out here because they'll make sense to us as we work our way through. Because time does not permit us to do a verse by verse through Matthew 24, or we'd be here till Lyndon gets his voice back. And that's going to be a long time. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and then he says, you need to flee. When you look at Mark 13, verse 14, he says, when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not. Luke says in Luke 21, refers to it as the holy place. Just like Matthew does here. That place is not for Gentiles. It's only for Jews. And it is only for special Jews who are in the priesthood. So, when they see the Romans, that's when these things are going to take place. And as the siege begins early, and then inexplicably, we know providentially God called him to remove the army. But when Titus comes back in, all of the Christians were gone. Historically, we have no record of any Christians being killed in the destruction of Jerusalem. They all recognized the signs that had been taught by Jesus, and they got out of there. Jesus makes a number of comments, you know, woe to them that are nursing and things like that. You know, ladies, I've never nursed. But I can remember just to go to the store during the times when Susie was nursing, we had to carry like 7 suitcases of stuff just to go to the grocery store because you have all this stuff. I mean, ladies, you know, I mean, you can't just walk out the door. So, you know, whenever you go somewhere, you've got to plan for it. And all of a sudden now, you've got to leave and flee and not know where you're going, and you're carrying a nursing child. That would be exceptionally traumatic, I would imagine. So in Josephus, book 6, The Wars of the Jews, in chapter 9, and we're going to look down in section 2, and the notes are notes 415 through 418. But together with those whom they had orders to slay, they slew the aged and the infirmed, But for those that were in their flourishing age and who might be useful to them, they drove them together into the temple and shut them within the walls of the court of the women, over which Caesar set one of his freedmen, as also Fronto, one of his own friends, which last was to determine everyone's fate according to his merits. So this one person was to determine the fate of everyone else. So this Fronto slew all those who had been seditious and robbers, who were impeached by one another. But of the young men, he chose out of the tallest and most beautiful and reserved them for the triumph. And as for the rest of the multitude that were above 17 years old, he put them into bonds and sent them to the Egyptian mines. Titus also sent a great number into the provinces as a present to them, that he might be that they might be destroyed upon their theaters by the sword and by wild beast. But those that were under 17 years were sold for slaves. Now, when you read that, you can see they were killing them and they were enslaving them. Killing and enslaving. Dropping down to section 3, notes 420 and 421, and then I'm going to read a footnote B that is placed in here that is a historical reference to add to it. 420 and 421. Now, the number of those that were carried captive during the whole war was collected to be 97,000. As was the number of those that perished during the whole siege, 1,100,000. That's 1.1 million. 11,000, the greater part of whom were indeed of the same nation with the citizens of Jerusalem, but not belonging to the city itself. For they had come up from all the country to the feast of unleavened bread, and were on a sudden shut up by an army, which at the very first occasioned so great a traitness among them that there came a destruction upon them, and soon afterwards such a famine as destroyed them more suddenly. You want to do the most damage? When you destroy Jerusalem during Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, a little bit later, he's going to record how many people could have been there based on the number of sacrifices that were done. And they factor it out through a two-hour period from the 9th to the 11th hour. And they factored that 2,700,200 persons could have been in Jerusalem during the time of sacrifice. So there were not even as many as could have been there. Dropping down to the note B, the whole multitude of the Jews that were destroyed during the entire 7 years before this time in all the countries of and bordering on Judea is summed up by Archbishop Usher of Lipsius out of Josephus at the year of Christ 70 and amounts to 1,337,490. That's how many were killed that weren't in Jerusalem. Nor could there have been that number of Jews in Jerusalem to be destroyed in this siege, as will be presently set down by Josephus, but that both Jews and proselytes of justice were just then come up out of their countries of Galilee, Samaria, Judea, and Perea. What he's saying there is that 1.1 million did not live in Jerusalem. There were not that many that lived there. The reason there were so many there is they had come up for the feast in vast numbers and therein cooped up as in a prison by the Roman army, as Josephus himself well observes. And in this, the next section is exactly relates to elsewhere. Dropping down to section 4 of chapter 9, section 429, according to the multitude of those that therein perished exceeded all the destructions that either men or God ever brought upon the world. For to speak only of what was publicly known, the Romans slew some of them. Some they carried captive, others made search for underground, and when they were found as they were, they broke up the ground and slew all of them. The multitude of those that therein perished exceeded all the destructions that either men or God ever brought upon the world. In Luke chapter 21, in the same conversation that it's in Matthew 24, Luke writes in verses 20 through 24, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath upon this people." Verse 24, "And they will fall by the edge of the sword, and will be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Mark 13:19, relating to verse 24. For in those days there will be tribulation such as not been since the beginning of creation, which God created, until this time, nor ever shall be. That note I just read said that neither man nor God had ever destroyed as many people as the Roman army destroyed. Jesus says right here, before it happened, there will never again be anything as bad as that. How does Matthew put it in Matthew 24, verse 21? For then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor shall ever be. So what are we dealing with here? We're dealing with an incredibly complex situation that nobody has ever seen on planet Earth before or since. Jesus is telling them, Matthew records, I take early dates for a lot of the recordings. I know a lot of modern scholars like the later dates because it allows them to undermine the text. Most modern scholars place the writing of Matthew after AD 70 because Matthew couldn't have known those things were going to happen. But the evidence shows that it was written in Hebrew probably around the year 48 and translated into Greek by the year 50. Mark was written around 50 or 52. Luke was written around the year 58 to 60. And you date Luke by the book of Acts, and we know the date of Acts. So you back up because it was written prior to Acts. So as you look at those things and understand, Jesus is warning people of something they've never seen before. And so he's using all of this language to try to gather their attention. When you're talking about the judgment and the end of the age, that's Matthew 24, 30 and 31, as well as 36 through 44. He answers those questions there. The parable of the 10 virgins. You don't know when I'm coming. The parable of the talents. You don't know when your master's coming back. What does Jesus say? In verse 36, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. I want you to think about that and then think about the amount of arrogance it takes to write that Jesus gave us signs to look for right before he came back. When he says nobody knows. So he can't be giving signs about the nobody knows. He says nobody knows but my Father only. The angels don't know. And they're in the presence of the Father. Nobody knows. But as in the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. In the days of before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know that the flood till the flood came and took them away. So will the coming of the Son of Man. You look and think about these things. I've got a notebook full of predictions of dates. Predictions of people that are now passed away that were the Antichrist. And that Jesus is coming back in our lifetime. He might. We don't know. But don't look in your newspaper. Don't watch the evening news. And get off the internet trying to figure it out when he's coming back. Jesus said nobody knows. Stop writing books about it. Stop selling DVDs about it. Here's something. All right, this doesn't cost you any extra. I won't ask you to put any extra money in the box on the way out the door. How about we focus on the things that we can know from Scripture? Let's spend our time on those things. like how we treat our wives and our husbands and our children and our parents, how we treat our brothers and sisters, how important it is to forgive, how important it is to work, not with eye service for men, but working unto the Lord, how important it is to treat our servants in our modern context, our employees, with respect, how to treat your master or your boss in the modern context with respect, how not to let any corrupt speech proceed from your mouth, but only that which is good for necessary edification. There's a lot that we know. And because we don't know this, everybody focuses on it. Because they think they have some access to some hidden knowledge. It's not there. It's not there. Now, the end of the age, the Jewish economy, what we looked at previously was the end of the Christian age, the coming at the end of time, is in 429 and 32 through 35. It talks about the destruction of Jerusalem in those contexts. Well, that was me. I put my thumb in the wrong place, and I kept it there for far too long. There we go. Judaism ceased to function as it had been intended and purposed by God in AD 70, and it never, ever returned again. It ended with the destruction of Jerusalem. Yes, we have people today who are Jews. Yes, they do practice some created form of Judaism, but guess what they haven't done since prior to AD 70? No sacrifices. Guess what was also in the temple? All the genealogies. Guess who cannot say that they're a Levite or of the tribe of Judah any longer? There's not a single Jew on earth that knows their tribe. I think God intentionally did that. He gave them 40 years of grace between Calvary and the destruction of Jerusalem to recognize their error in killing his son and come into proper relationship with him through Jesus Christ. And then the punishment came. Now, in the conclusion, there are no signs about Jesus' return. You know what the sign is? When you see him in the sky. That's the sign he told us. When you see the Son of Man coming, that's your sign. Guess what? It's over. It's over. Now, there's a small section in here that talks about what people refer to as the rapture. Verse 40, two men will be in the field, one taken, the other left. Two will be grinding at the mill, one taken and one left. Watch therefore, because you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. Now, this is a commentary on Matthew from somebody that doesn't agree with us on a lot of things. This is German Reform theology. And William Hendrickson is the one who wrote this. He translated the text out of Greek into German. He did not use the King James or any other version of the Bible. He translated it himself and did an outstanding job, by the way, in all of his commentaries. When he died, Simon Kistemacher took over and completed the commentary set. I have the complete commentary. And it's one of the best commentary sets outside of a few bones you got to pick out for sure. I would like to be able to read this from the German and translate it into English for you, but I can't. Fortunately, it's in English. Just seeing who's paying attention or who thinks I could actually read German. The two men shall be in the field. One is taken, one left behind. Two women shall be grinding at the handmill. One is taken, one left behind. Here's his comment. It is clear that once this final day arrives, every opportunity still to be saved is gone forever. The door is shut. The Lord arrives. Of two men engaged in the same kind of work, probably even toiling next to one another in the field, one is taken. By the angels he is gathered to be forever with the Lord, the other left behind, assigned to everlasting perdition. The same thing happens in the case of two women who were at that very moment grinding at the handmill. The lesson is the same. One of the two is taken, the other left behind. The one who takes the Son of Man himself, the one who takes them is the Son of Man himself through the agency of angels. When you look at the context of 36 down past these verses, you will notice he is talking about the end of time. He is not talking about the preview to 7 years of tribulation or 3.5 years of tribulation preceding a 1,000-year reign on earth. He's talking about the very end here. And this is attested to over and over and over again by scholars of different ages, from different countries, of different belief systems when it comes to Christianity. What we have in Matthew 24 is a blueprint for the destruction of Jerusalem, not for instruction for end-time Christians. The only thing that is left for us is to be watchful and be ready. If you look at Matthew 24:42, he tells us, "Watch therefore, for you do not know the hour that your Lord is coming." Over in chapter 25, verse 13, at the conclusion of the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, remember, C-H-A-P-T-E-R, numeral 25 is not a part of the original text. This is part of what we're reading in chapter 24, verse 13. "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." What is the entire point of what he's saying? We've got to be watchful. If you knew when Jesus was coming back, how would you live? Now, a lot of us in our self-righteousness would say, "Oh, I would be so good. I'd be so righteous. You know, I would be planning for his return." Most people, because of human nature, they'd be living like the devil till the week before. Not a good plan, because you don't know you're going to make it till then. We don't know when Jesus is coming back. Matthew 24 does not tell us that, nor does it give us signs about his return. But historically, we know that those things pertained to the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, I've kept you 15 minutes late. Hopefully, he's got a very short invitation song, but it'll be long enough for you to make your way forward should you have need of anything this evening. If you need prayers, we had a brother come forward today with a very special concern. If you have a concern, maybe it's your health, maybe it's your job situation, it could be a number of different things. Or if you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ and you would like to know how to put on Christ in baptism, won't you come forward as together we stand and sing?